It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Last month, the Environmental Protection Agency announced it was proposing sweeping regulatory changes to limit climate-altering carbon dioxide from existing power plants, especially coal-fired power plants. The goal is to reduce carbon dioxide emissions by 30% by setting individual targets for different states. It calls for Pennsylvania, which the U.S. Department of Energy ranks as the nation's fourth largest coal-producing state, to reduce power plant emissions by 32% by 2030. Republicans on the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee attacked the EPA's proposal as extreme and costly, and some went as far as calling it a federal takeover of the energy industry. EPA leaders say that their staff worked long hours and heard from literally thousands of stakeholders, and they will hear more during a series of upcoming hearings in four U.S. cities, including Pittsburgh, tomorrow and Friday. Environmentalists strongly support the emissions reductions. Industry leaders say they would be devastating to the economy. Both sides are pushing their message. But as Rhode Island Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse put it, both sides must decide whether the cost of compliance is worth the health and environmental benefits. I'm joined now in Studio A by George Ellis. He is president of the Pennsylvania Coal Alliance. George Ellis, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Christina Simeone, director of the Penn Future Energy Center. Christina, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me.
George Ellis, let me begin with you. As you know, the EPA is proposing a 32% reduction in power plant emissions by 2030. How does that impact the coal industry in this state, and what would it take to meet that goal?
Unfortunately, probably a closure of most of our coal-fired power plants. That's the key. That's our concern. If you look at the options that EPA considers to be the best strategies for emission reduction, and if based on projected coal consumption levels predicted to or provided to our Pennsylvania DEP by our electric utilities, to meet the federal regulation targets, you're going to see a decrease by about 70% in coal consumption by Pennsylvania utilities by 2030. That essentially would reduce consumption levels, which are now about 33 million tons for utilities, to 10 million tons. More important, well, I mean that's certainly a striking stat, but perhaps more importantly is the annual capacity factor of these plants. That is, how much time during a given year will they be operating? Would be reduced from about 55% to 17%, and as a result, you're not going to be able to keep these plants operational from an economical standpoint just 17% at a time, you know, in any given year. So we are very concerned about having taking coal out of the electric generation portfolio and the impact that that has not only on our jobs and our industries and our workers, but also on electric utility rates and the availability of electric supplies.
So you're saying that what the EPA is asking the coal industry to do by 2030, the year 2030, that it would shut down the coal industry?
I think it has that potential. Yeah, I think if it reduces coal burn by the numbers that are being projected, if we're going from a 55% capacity factor to a 17% capacity factor, it really makes these plants uneconomical to run. So,
and how, in your estimation, would this impact consumers? What will we see in terms of where will our electric bill be, say, by 2030?
Right now, you know, coal in gas are essentially your lowest cost fuel, and so in 40% of our electricity in Pennsylvania comes from coal. So if you take that away, and if it's made up, depending upon how it's displaced. If it's displaced by gas, assuming gas stays at the same rate, but there are other projections, the more it's just the fundamental supply and demand, the more demand for the commodity, the price will increase. If you look at the other building blocks that EPA suggests, which is, for example, going to renewables, you're talking about going from a lower cost fuel mix to a higher cost fuel mix, and it's not just the cost, but it's also it affects the reliability of supply. Coal units are base load units, meaning that they're in place 24/7, and generally the first units for utilities to run. If you take that base load capacity away and you go with the gas, a combined cycle type gas, and then you add the cost of renewables, which are intermittent sources because, you know, the sun doesn't shine all the time and the wind doesn't blow, then you know, you're risking your availability of supply. And, you know, during this past winter, we had that sustained period of abnormally cold weather, and the demand increased. And I think about 92% of that additional demand was made up by coal power generation. And most of that coal, It came from utilities, from power plants that are very vulnerable to being shut down under this proposal.
Christina Simeone of the Penn Future Energy Center, you've heard George Ellis lay out the economic impact of this EPA proposal. Is the cost of compliance worth the health and environmental benefits?
Well, I think the cost of compliance issue is predicated on a notion that this rule is going to cost us too much money. And I think there's many ways for us to actually see an economic potential gains through energy efficiency, which is our least cost resource, and renewable energy, which can actually help reduce power prices. Our power grid supplier, PJM, did a study and found that increasing renewable energy to 20 or 30% of grid supply can actually reduce wholesale power prices from between $9 billion and $21 billion annually, all while having no negative impact to reliability. So we can have clean energy resources. We can have energy efficient resources without sacrificing reliability. I think that there's the potential for us, again, to see economic gains in growth industries like clean energy. I think there are also, when we're looking at the costs of potential regulation, we have to look at what the basis of this rule is. Again, protecting public health and also protecting against some of the worst damages from climate change. The cost of extreme weather events in 2012 to the United States is over $100 billion. We have a national flood control program that's in debt. We have crop insurance programs that are paying out record amounts of claims. We are seeing the impacts of extreme weather, and the taxpayers are being saddled with a lot of those costs. The White House Council of Economic Advisors found that every decade that we wait to act on climate change we experience an increased cost of mitigation by 40%. So I think it should be our leaders that look at EPA's framework and say, okay, you know, there are good things, there's maybe some things that we can work out that we need to work on, but how can we use this framework and implement a plan that is, for our economy, the best case scenario, and then focus on lowering the negative impact to public health and lowering these damaging costs from extreme weather that is really the foundation of why we're doing this rule. And what I would also say is if the coal and other impacted industries believe that EPA's rule is going to cost too much, I would say, okay, well, what is the alternative? If not EPA's rule, what do you want to do instead? What is an alternative way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions? And I think when you look at industries like the pesticide industry, when scientific information found that DDT was damaging, or when we found out that lead and gas was damaging, or when we found out that certain aerosols caused holes in the ozone layer, these industries, when facing scientific information that said they were damaging public health and the environment, launched campaigns of denying the science, and then when denying the science didn't work, delaying the regulation. And I, from my perspective, this is what is happening here. We can't continue to delay. We will increase our costs. We have to act. And EPA has put a strong framework that balances economics and technical feasibility.
We're discussing the Environmental Protection Agency's proposed new regulations with George Ellis, president of the Pennsylvania Coal Alliance, and Christina Simeone, who you just heard, director of the Penn Future Energy Center. You can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address, ESSPGH@WESA.FM. On Twitter, at ESSPGH, hashtag EP Live. And again, our number, 412-246-2002. Christina Simeone, one of the complaints coming from some in Congress is that the representatives don't get to vote on this. They feel ultimately that the American people are not being given a voice on this, ergo the idea that this is a government takeover, as some have called it. As far as you're concerned, do the people that are saying this, do they have a point?
Well, we have to remember that the EPA is taking this action because they're compelled to do so by law and the courts under the Clean Air Act. Congress passed the Clean Air Act. So Congress has weighed in by establishing the Clean Air Act to protect public health. Congress also, for over a decade, has been debating climate change legislation. I mean, there have, over 10 years of debate on climate change legislation. There was a piece of climate change legislation that actually passed out of the House back in, I believe, 2009, 2010. Congress has failed to act. The science is clear that these are real costs to the United States and beyond. If Congress cannot if Congress is stalled and fails to act, then the EPA has to move forward. So I would turn that question right back on those policymakers.
And George Ellis, you've heard, I'm sure, many environmentalists talk about the carbon emissions and what they do to our environment. Evidence shows carbon pollution is one of the key drivers of global warming, or climate change, if you prefer. Pennsylvania is contributing to carbon pollution, so doesn't the Commonwealth need to do its share here? And in your opinion, what is the fair share? If in fact, what you're saying is that the EPA is asking too much of the coal industry, what is a fair requirement for emission reductions?
Okay, there's a couple questions there that I'd just like to – that I think I can address. The first one is what are the benefits of this rule, and there has been much debate about that. The fact of the matter is we're talking about a global transport problem. So the United States acting unilaterally is not going to make the measurable environmental improvements as what is being proposed.
You're saying that if the United States acting alone to reduce carbon emissions isn't going to be enough, if India and China and other countries are also emitting pollutants into the air.
In coal, last year, global coal use grew by 3%, faster than any other fossil fuel source, a sure indication that other parts of the world aren't turning their back on coal but embracing it. Now, reportedly, we will be testifying tomorrow at the EPA hearing, and what we'd like to know is what are the benefits of the proposal. What we're hearing is that if the proposal is adopted and implemented by 2030, you're going to see a 1% net reduction in overall global emissions. And if that's the case, then you measure your costs accordingly. I mean, So the cost to impose the regulations to generate a 1% total benefit, I mean, what did that cost be, say, on our domestic manufacturing base that has to compete globally? And
Is there a chance, if I may jump in, is there a chance, though, that if the United States, that if these standards are adopted, if they are in fact put into law and these requirements are imposed on the industry, that the United States would be taking the lead and that other countries might not follow?
I wouldn't bet on countries, particularly like China, to follow the United States lead on any of an issue. But could I just
sure.
one other thing?
Very quickly.
There's this assumption that nothing is being done in Pennsylvania on climate change, and that's wrong. If you look at DEP statistics between the period 2005 and 2012, we have reduced our emissions carbon dioxide by 12%, and what they're projecting is a 22% reduction through 2020. So we have a 12%, and it looks like we'll get to a 22%.
Okay, let me jump in because I want to move this along. Your point is well taken. So Christina Simeone, here's George Ellis of the Coal Alliance. He's saying the coal industry has made significant reductions already, and that if we try to hit this target by 2030, that it's not necessarily going to make a difference, especially when other countries, China being a prime example, aren't interested at all in the same type of carbon emission reductions that the U.S. is?
Well, I would actually challenge that statement by saying, you know, the European Union has greenhouse gas reductions 20% by 2020, 40% by 2030, and 80 to 95% by 2050. China also has plans to increase their non-fossil energy to 11%, and they have carbon intensity reduction and energy intensity reduction goals as well. China is spending more than the United States on clean energy as well, with over $60 billion in investment in 2013, while the United States was only at $48 billion. So
can we really rely on the Chinese? Can we take them, the Chinese government, at their word that they're despite all of their stated intentions, that they're really interested in doing this? The evidence shows that China historically has had a disregard for the environment.
Well, I think China's increasing energy needs is going to command them to do so. They're seeing.
Wouldn't it do the opposite if their energy needs are that great that they would sacrifice in aspects of the environment, of environmental safety, in order to keep the industry going and to meet the increasing demands?
Well, they're investing in other forms of energy in addition to coal. So they see clean energy as an opportunity. They're growing for the first time. We in the United States have made a lot of sunk investment into energy and energy infrastructure, whereas they're making investments for the first time. So out of the gate, making huge strides in clean energy is going to be helpful. And they have huge pollution problems, enormous pollution problems.
If we saw that in the Olympics, we saw athletes getting off the plane wearing masks over their faces because they couldn't breathe the air.
And
so
it's the same thing we've seen in the United States. They're going through similar problems. We've made great strides to improve air quality in the United States because it has real impacts not only to public health but also productivity of the economy as well.
So you're saying China will get there?
China will get there.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Rodney in Evans City would like to join the conversation. Rodney, thanks for waiting. You're on with George Ellis and Christina Simeone.
Yeah, I have a question for Mr. Ellis. I'm a little confused. You know, a couple years ago, the coal industry was running these ads saying clean coal is our future, and the don't hate coal because we have clean coal technology. Now when the regulations get ramped up, clean coal technology is nowhere in the discussion. Were those ads just fabrications trying to sell us, that somehow coal was going to be clean?
All right. George Ellis, what about Rodney's question?
Quite the opposite. I think, and I think Christina made this point in responding to your question, we have made great strides over the years in cleaning up our emission particularly our emissions of regulated pollutants. The term clean coal technology actually dates back to the late 60s and early 70s when the Clean Air Act was initially enacted.
And that refers mainly to sequestration?
No. It initially referred to reduction of acid rain precursors, sulfur, nitrogen oxides, and particulate matter. And these were technologies that, like flue gas, desulfurization scrubbers, SCR technologies. And so that's really how clean coal technology, the term, came into being.
And I guess another question someone might have that I would have is, is there really such a thing as clean coal? Can you really make it clean like solar energy or wind energy?
I think we have shown. I think given the reductions in regulated pollutants, we're talking about 60 to 70% across board since the 70s. Yes, I think where we have the challenge is going forward with carbon. Carbon is in terms of carbon capture and storage, is not there yet. Will it be there? You know, we'll find out over the next 10 or 15 years. But that's the one Achilles heel of the industry right now, is there is no proven deployable technology to regulate carbon, to reduce carbon.
And Christina Simeone, what about what George Ellis is saying about the strides that the coal industry has made?
The coal industry has made strides to improve regulated pollutants, but they've been forced to do so under the Clean Air Act. Many of the requirements that they're now forced to meet, like mercury, for example, I mean, the mercury rule was fought for 20 years. It was passed in the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments, and the industry fought it for 20 years before they actually had to comply. Getting back to making coal cleaner, the most important thing is putting a price on carbon. Once we put a price on carbon, that's going to send the economic signals for us to come up with the technologies. We are Americans. We innovate. We address challenges. But unless we take this problem on, and unless we put a price on carbon, there's going to be no price signals, no economic incentive for us to invest in the technologies and find a future for coal. I mean, I think in Pennsylvania it's critically important because, you know, yes, we have a natural gas industry that is helping us reduce our emissions. Do we have to worry about things like methane leakage for natural gas? Yes, that's something that we need to look at. For coal, do we have to worry about certain coal communities that, you know, as natural gas jobs increase and gas is outcompeting coal, are we losing some jobs on the coal sector? Yes. Do we need to worry about those communities? Absolutely. But we have to deal with those issues within the context of addressing climate change, putting a price on carbon, and finding a future for this country that's not subject to severe public health issues, extreme weather, and a volatile climate.
I want to thank both of our guests, Christina Simeone, director of Penn Future Energy Center, also George Ellis, president of the Pennsylvania Coal Alliance. Thank you both for joining us here for this first part of our discussion about the EPA's new proposed rules here on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul.
Coming up, we will look at the jobs and clean energy aspects of the proposed EPA rules. That's next as Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA.